This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Philip came to Beis Din to say that he had been raped by a man in the Then you only need one other witness who can join together with the man who was raped, and the two of them together can give evidence concerning the homosexual rapist, and capital punishment can be administered. Lirtzoinoi roshuhu. That if this person comes to Beis Din and says, this man had homosexual relationships with me and I was a willing partner, then roshuhu, then he is a rosho. If he's admitting to having willingly participated, va'atoyrom ra'atashis roshoed, and the Torah says you can't be a witness together with a rosho. So his evidence is inadmissible. You would need another two witnesses to give evidence. That's the view of Rav Yosef. Asks Tosfos, Ho Omar Hosum, does the Gemara not say in Bava Basra, Hachoshud al ha'aroyus al ha'arayus koshil idus? That if a person is suspected of being involved in improper relationships, he's still allowed to be a witness. Tosfos gives three answers, and therefore why is he allowed? And here we see that the person who claims to have been raped by a homosexual, or rather not raped, but having been seduced by a homosexual, do I use those terms? That's what they do. Is not allowed to give evidence. Why not, when we learnt in Bava Basra that if a person is suspected of improper intersexual behavior, he's still allowed to be a witness? So Tosfos gives several answers. The one is, there's a difference between admitting to it openly and being suspected of it. The second one he gives is Inami Hosam Koshu Mishum De Yitzrei Tokfe. There, with heterosexual relationships, there's such a strong Yetzer Hara that the fact that he's suspected of having improper sexual relationships does not mean that he's a bad person, an evil, wicked person who's going to lie under oath. It could be a person who's got a strong Yetzer Hara and he couldn't stand up to it. He's a weak character, that's all. But Tosfos wants to say that with homosexuality there isn't such a strong Yetzer Hara, and therefore that reasoning doesn't apply. And the third answer, Tosfos says, maybe even with homosexuality there could be such a strong Yetzer Hara, and there are other reasons why here he would not be accepted as a witness. The phrase that Tosfos uses, Mishum de Yitzroi Tokfoi Kolkach, his Yetzer Hara, his passion to do wrong is so powerful, the Choshuv Ke'onus, that he is considered as if acting under compulsion. And that's why he's allowed to give evidence. He's not considered a Rosha in a normal sense. If a person goes along and he eats on Yom Kippur, well, there's not such a strong Yetzer Hara to eat on Yom Kippur. Why did he do it? He's a Rosha, that's why he does it. He doesn't care. He doesn't feel for these things. A person's Mechalel Shabbos. He knows it's Shabbos. He's studied. He knows he shouldn't do it on Shabbos. And he's Mechalel Shabbos. He goes and he drives publicly and parks his car right outside the shul. Well, there's not such a strong Yetzer Hara. He could do it quietly. He could do it behind the scenes. To go and do it blatantly. Why does he do it? He's a Rosha. But if a person is involved in improper sexual relationship, while that cannot be condoned in any way whatsoever, nevertheless, it doesn't make him a rosho quite to the same degree, although the Avera is very bad, but the psychological motivation for the Avera is less immoral. In a funny way, it's less destructive. It's weak character. It's not aggressiveness. It's not destructiveness. It's not as negative. Interesting concept. And this was brought recently in a public talk as an indication of a degree not of condoning, but nevertheless of not penalizing a homosexual. The discussion was taking place, particularly in relation to AIDS victims. To what extent they can be allowed to contribute to normal Jewish life, to be a chazan, to be a rov, to do kriyas haTorah, to duchen. It's all very well. Nebuch is ill, he's got AIDS, but the illness is the result of improper behavior. And is it right? Isn't it right? Rosh or not a Rosh? This was brought to say, you see, there are times where the fact that he doesn't make him, although it's a terrible thing that he did, but the motivation, the impulse is so strong in his case possibly, that it doesn't make him quite such a Rosh. And I want to go into the background of the concept a little bit of moral responsibility. Because the question was raised, well, then everybody can claim that everything they do wrong. Yitzhak Tokfer, what can I do? I had a strong Yitzhara, what could I do? Where is the boundary line? And I thought that this week would be a good week to discuss the matter and at least to open some of the areas of discussion, because Paro was just such a person who, on the surface, appears to have been able to claim I was acting by compulsion. If we can analyze a little bit the extent of Paro's moral responsibility, perhaps we will be able to understand a little bit of the subject. Avraham Avinu is told in Parshas Lech Lecha, Ki geir yiyeh zarecho ba'oretz lo lohem, your children are going to be foreigners in a strange land, the Ivdu Esom, the Inu Esom, and they will be worked and afflicted. And then Hashem says to Avram, finally they will go out with a chush godel, they will go out very wealthy. And also the nation who enslaves them, I shall judge. And the question is asked by all the Rishonim, how can you judge them if they have, if it was decreed that that's what they have to do? One of the people who asks that question is the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva in the sixth Perek. Where he says, "V'aloi kosuv batoiro v'ovdum v'inuaisom." Does it not say in the Torah that they will work them and afflict them? Hare gozar ala mitzrim la'asos ro, so Hashem decreed that the Egyptians shall do bad to the Jews. And the Rambam answers and says, Chen ha-mitzrim kol echod ve-echod ma'isun ha-mitzrim v'hamirim li-Israel. Each one of those individual Egyptians and those who did bad to the Jews, ilu loy rotzo lehora lohem harushus b'yodah. If each individual wanted to get out of it, they could have. Shaloi gozar al-ish yadua, because Hashem did not decree that any specific man shall do the crime. Hashem decreed that a nation in general was going to do it. But you don't have to be the one. That is choice. Good, so you can ask, but somebody's going to have to do it? Sure, somebody's going to have to do it. Unfortunately, there will be many volunteers. There won't be a shortage of volunteers. Not like cleaning the Beis HaMedrash for Pesach. It's difficult to find a volunteer. To talk of exterminating some Jews, there'll be many volunteers. So you don't have to volunteer. There's enough people to do it. That's how the Rambam deals with it. Asks the Rambam, "V'loy niskunu dvarov etzli," and his words are not. Don't settle with me, says the Rambam. Shafilu gozo she'echod mikol ha'umais yuri olehem, bekach bekach. let us say Hashem merely, let us accept that Hashem merely decreed that a nation will afflict them. Ve'kodom zeh ve'osog zeh rosu shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this one jumped in and said, I want to do Hashem's will. Zocha b'dvar mitzvah. They should be rewarded for doing a mitzvah. Doing Hashem's will is a mitzvah. And just as if Hashem wants Amalek to be wiped out, that is a mitzvah. So if Hashem wants the Jews to be wiped out, that it becomes a mitzvah. And if a nation volunteers to do it, they should be rewarded, asks the Ramban. Umatam bidvorov kashi yitzave Amalek shiasu b'nei amdina plini maisim in amaisim. What is it when a king instructs, a general instruction that he wants his population to do a certain act? If one wants to get out of it and wants to leave it to others, he's a sinner. That's an aggressive, bad thing to do. And somebody who does it will get a medal. So if in an army, if a commander says, I want that village taken, and everybody shuffles and looks for somebody else to do it, the commander's going to get angry. But if a group of people come along and say, right, we'll go and do it. Or if they go and they wipe the village out, they come back and they get a medal. Ask the Ramban, so if you're going to say, Ramban, that yes, this was decreed, only it wasn't decreed on a specific person, and nobody had to volunteer, still, says the Ramban, those who did volunteer should have been rewarded, not punished. Because at the end of the day, they performed the mitzvah. They fulfilled the will of Hashem. That's Ramban's question. And therefore the Ramban learns it differently. And he says, there's a principle in the Posuk, in Zechariah, Asher ani kotzavti ma'at v'hema ozru l'ro. Where Hashem says, I got a little angry and the goyim helped me so much to do bad. The Egyptians did more bad than they were entitled to. They threw the little boys into the village. And they embittered their lives. And they wanted to wipe out, to exterminate the Jews. And that's what Dan Anoichi means. I'm going to judge them for going further than they were entitled to go. I said that they would work the Jews and afflict them, but I didn't say they would exterminate them. That was their own free choice, and for that they're going to have to pay. They went too far. So we have two views, the view of the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam says nobody was compelled to do anything. There was a general intent that each person acted entirely on their own volition. The Ramban says there was compulsion. But had they stuck to what they were compelled to do, they would not have been punished. They were being punished for doing far more than they were compelled to do. That's how the Ramban learned. The Meshech Chochma explains it even further and says that explains the Rambam further and says it's true that there was a general statement that a nation was going to afflict the Jews, and the Jews landed up in Egypt. At that point, says the Meshech Chochma, the last people who had any right to afflict the Jews were the Egyptians. Why? Even if it's a mitzvah, says the Ramban. Okay, Ramban, you're right, says the Meshech Chochma. Ramban, you're right. If the Ribbono Shel Olam gave an instruction that a nation is to afflict the Jews, the nation who does it is performing a mitzvah. But not Egypt. They had no right to do it. Why not? We learn further on in Bamidbar that Hashem gives Moshe an instruction, you remember, to wipe out the Midianim, to wipe out the Midianite people. Moshe doesn't go himself. Moshe sends Pinchas to lead the army against Midian. Asks the Medrash and the Yalkut Shimoni, why did he send Pinchas? Hashem instructs him, that's not a nice thing to do. Hashem gives him an instruction to go and wipe out the Midianites. That's a mitzvah. If it's a mitzvah, you should do it yourself. You don't send somebody else to do the mitzvah. Answers the Yalkut. Since Moshe was raised in Midian and protected in Midian after he ran away from Paro, that's where he was raised, that's where he married, he lived there for many years. He felt that as far as HaKoros HaTov was concerned, he could not go. He could not be the one to wipe out Midian. He owed Midian a debt of gratitude. Even though Midian were bad and evil and they needed to be wiped out and somebody was going to be wiping them out and he was going to give the command, but he wasn't going to do it. Pinchas was going to do it. Good, but that's the question is still there. Hashem said, you must do it. Who are you, Moshe, to start making calculations? Hashem says, go and wipe out Midian. And you start with the whole thing, I'm not going to do it, I'll send Pinchas. Hashem didn't say send Pinchas. Hashem said, you do it. What gave Moshe the right to send Pinchas? Explains of Chaim Shmuel Levitz, that when an instruction goes against, when an instruction of the Torah goes against the principle of derech eretz, of menschlichkeit, then one knows that one has misunderstood the instruction. Cannot be. You cannot have an instruction from Hashem that should go against your humanity. We discussed in the recent shir that that's out of the question. To sacrifice menschlichkeit to do a mitzvah, that's no mitzvah. At the end of the day, you have to be a human being. Sometimes you sacrifice mitzvahs in order to remain alive. But to sacrifice life for a mitzvah, you don't do. And you don't sacrifice ethical life either. If a human being is going to sacrifice his menschlichkeit, he ceases to be a human being. And that's no longer living by the Torah. That's no longer a life. And where are... where all the players formed by the water saved him when he was a baby. And the land helps him out. Remember when he had to kill that Egyptian, he had to bury the Egyptian in the land, and the land hid the body so that Moshe wasn't found out, so he had a chance to get away. So Moshe owed a debt of gratitude to the water and to the land. And therefore Hashem, when it came to those plagues, says to him, tell Aaron to do the plague, not you. From there Moshe learned that Hashem would never expect of us to do something which counteracts the principles of HaKoros HaTov. And on that basis, says the Meshech Chochmah, the Egyptians should have known when Hashem said, and a nation is going to arise who will enslave the people, he didn't mean Egypt. Because Egypt owed the Jews a debt of gratitude. Yosef saved their lives. And it couldn't be that they were meant. It's an incredible concept. Which goes again along the lines that we've been discussing in other shiurim, that the human being is capable through his own actions of overriding the will of Hashem. Hashem allows it to happen, but it is not necessarily coincidental with Hashem's will, with his desire, with his decree. It is not possible that Hashem would have decreed that Egypt should be the ones to enslave the Jews. Hashem wouldn't even allow Moshe to strike the land. Hashem doesn't expect Moshe to conquer Midian, although these are great mitzvahs, but you can't do it, Moshe. Somebody else must do it. You owe a debt of gratitude. How would he have expected the Egyptians to be the one to enslave the Jews when they owe the Jews a debt of gratitude? It couldn't be. And says the Meshech Chochmah, if they would have analyzed it morally, they would have realized it's not them. And they would have had to leave it to somebody else. Not just because you don't have to be the volunteer. The way we normally understand the Rambam is that you don't have to volunteer. There are plenty of other people. Says the Meshech Chochmah, more than that, you know for sure that it's not you. You Egyptian, it can't be you. It must be somebody else. And therefore they had no right to do it at all. That's how the Meshech Chochmah learns it. But according to the Ramban, they were compelled to go a certain part of the way, and had they limited themselves to the extent to which they were compelled to go, they would not have been punished. What were they punished for? is the Ramban suggesting that they were only punished for the extra, or were they punished for everything? Reading through the parashas, on the surface it appears they were punished for everything, not just for the extra. They were not punished only for killing the first, for killing the children. They were not punished only for going over the limits. They seem to have been punished for everything, but that's also understandable. Because if you go further than you are compelled to go, that is a sign that even if you weren't compelled, you would have done it nevertheless. For example, you have the old moral defense that the Germans put up after the war. We were acting under orders. Waldheim's trying it now as well. I did it to save my skin, is what he says now, and anybody would have done the same. Is that a valid defense? Good, it depends what. To go and kill one, a person to save your skin, you're not allowed to do. Who says his skin is less valuable than yours? You're playing God. So you can't save your skin, you can't kill somebody to save your skin. But let's say Waldheim says, I didn't know they were being killed, which is what he does say. I wasn't killing people. I was deporting them to what I believed was labor camps. So the world is saying, well, that's bad enough. You shouldn't have done that either. And he says, I did that to save my skin. Is that a valid moral defense? The answer is yes. If somebody comes up and holds a gun against your head and says, you deport those people to a labor camp or I'll kill you, you deport them to a labor camp. That on the surface, one would be able to do, provided, to the best of your knowledge, their lives are not endangered at the labor camp. So it's not a nice thing to do, and it's not a good thing, and a moral and ethical thing to do. But that, to save one's life, what can you do? And so, for example, when you see these documentary film footages of these stormtroopers and these SS people, leave aside even the murdering, just the handling of the Jews, coming into their homes and deporting them, confiscating their property. Just the handling of them. And they claim in defense, we were under orders. We have nothing against Jews, we were under orders. Is that a moral defense? The answer is, if you went into a Jewish home with tears running down your face, and you called the balabos and you said, I'm terribly sorry to have to do this, but I'm under orders. I've got to deport you. It'll be best for you if you come without resistance. I've also got to confiscate your property. I'll tell you exactly where I'm sending it. Maybe you'll be able to get it back. It breaks my heart to have to do this. Come, can I help you down the stairs? Can I help you into the van? Have you got everything you would like to take with you? Can I go back and fetch anything for you? Then you're entitled to claim I was doing it under orders, because I didn't do one thing more than I was ordered to do. And I did it with a heavy heart. And I did it with reluctance. I did it to save my life. I hated every minute of it. But when you see the film footages of the gusto, with the zrizus, the energy, the vitality with which they did it, that they weren't commanded to do. And therefore your whole defense of I was acting under compulsion falls away and becomes invalid. And nothing you did is considered to be under compulsion, because the way you did it is megale. The way you did it reveals what was inside you. The way you did it reveals that that was you doing it. The compulsion, that was only permission you were waiting for. That wasn't compulsion. That's something you've been dying to do for generations. And at last you've had an opportunity to vent your feelings. That's clear from the way you do it. And then you can no longer use the defense of I was acting under orders. And so it is with the Mitzvah. That they were compelled to do certain things, says the Ramban, not the Ramban, but says the Ramban, that yes. That they went so much further, they put so much science into it, and so much energy and thought into it, that for that there's no excuse. Such meticulousness. Even when the Germans were on the retreat, they were still busy trying to exterminate as many as they could, when they knew they'd lost. They were running. While they were running, they were still making sure that they could burn as many bodies as they could. How does one explain that? Acting under compulsion? Acting under orders? That's a geschmack already for murder. Those are people who are enjoying what they're doing. And there one has to be very careful not to be blinded by these stories of acting under compulsion. And so also in our case of the person who misbehaves himself heterosexually or homosexually and claims, I'm acting under compulsion. An internal compulsion. I can't control myself. I have an enormous yetzer, I cannot control myself. Even if we'll accept that, we would have to see how he acts. Does he do it with worry and with guilt? No, he says, my psychiatrist says it's bad to feel guilty. My psychiatrist says, if you're doing that, you might as well enjoy it already. Okay, you might as well enjoy it already. Gone is your claim that you're acting under compulsion. You see a person, each time he does it, gets into a state of depression and guilt again, and has to spend 6 hours with his psychiatrist. And his psychiatrist doesn't try to tell him he's guiltless. His psychiatrist explains to him, it's a terrible thing that you've done. But still, okay, you know, it's true, you've got to pull yourself together again. Start again, and one can't allow this to destroy one's life. But no, if the two of them sit and they have a l'chaim over it, and they talk over the details again, and the psychiatrist is enjoying hearing all about it as much as the fellow who did it is enjoyed doing it, and all they're doing is getting ready for the next time, that you can't claim tok for alai yitzri. What can I do? Strong yitzhara. Rebellion always used to explain the din that if a woman is married and she commits adultery, chas v'sholem, and there are witnesses and there was warning, then she gets the death sentence. Which death sentence does she get? She gets chenek. Chenek was the cutest of the death sentences because the chenek was strangulation, but they used to do it very sensitively. The rope was covered with cotton wool so it shouldn't hurt the neck. It was done very nicely. What happens if the woman was an aruso? She was not yet living with her husband. They were only betrothed, but betrothed in halacha means more than in secular, in English terms. That means that they had the first part of the wedding ceremony already. The ring was given, but there hadn't yet been a chuppah, so they were not living together yet. If at that point she commits adultery, then she also gets the death sentence, but she gets skila. Now, skila is not a sensitive death sentence. That's quite a messy one, where they're taken up to the top of a building and they're pushed over the edge. And it makes a mess on the ground. And if it doesn't do the job properly, they find a big heavy stone and they drop it on the chest. And if that doesn't do the job properly, they try another one. And again until finally it does the job properly. It's not a nice one at all. Skila is the worst of the death sentences. Chenek is the easiest of the death sentences. And there are four grades. After Chenek, there is Saif, which is the guillotine. After Saif, there is Sreifa, which is also not such a nice one. It's not the Sowetan necklace. Sreifa is not the necklace. Sreifa is the pouring of molten lead down the throat. It's not very pleasant. That still doesn't mutilate the body on the outside, so it's not so bad. Skilo mutilates the body on the inside and the outside. It's the most terrible of all death sentences. Ask Sibelia, why is that? If she's married already and they're living together, you would think that's a much greater act of treachery and she should get skilo and the aruso should only get chenek. Why is it the other way around? If they're only betrothed, she gets chenek. She gets the light. If they're only betrothed, she gets skilo. And if they're married properly, then she only gets chenek. Explains rebellion, because when they're betrothed, the husband and wife are not living together. So the wife is quite relaxed in the company of her lover. She doesn't expect that she might be intruded upon in the middle. Whereas when she's married, the husband could walk in at any time, and she's nervous and scared and guilty. And that guilt diminishes the aveira. For her to feel all the way through that she's doing wrong, maybe he'll walk in and what will happen then? That guilt, which destroys part of the enjoyment of the aver, also diminishes a little bit the severity of the guilt attached, of the responsibility attached to the aver. Whereas the abandon and relaxation with which the arusa can do it that's much more serious, and that's why she gets the more serious death sentence. And so it is here. The person claims, Tokfo alav yitzri, and I don't know what to do about it, and I've been trying to see psychiatrists to stop it, and I want to stop it, and I try, and it's happened again. And you say to the person, do you enjoy it? He says, no, where from enjoy it? I feel dirtied, and I feel impure, and I feel let down. I don't enjoy it at all. I don't know what it is that drives me every time to do it. No. There you might have a case of Tokfo alav yitzri, a person whose valid claim that he has some kind of drive in him, and he doesn't know how to control it. There's an obsession. But if he enjoys it, and it's a tainug, and it's fun, that's no Tokfo alav yitzri. What about tshuva? Good, okay, Tokfo alav yitzri. He's now obsessed, and he's on and on, and he's trying to break free. What then? That also revolves around the case of our friend Paro. Because Paro, we're told that Hashem hardened his heart. Explains the Rambam in the same Perek. The Efshar Sheyecheto Odom Chet Godo Oichatoim Rabin. It is possible that a person commits a very severe Avera or many Averas. Ad Sheyisein Hadin Lifnei Dayan HaEmes. To the point where the true judge considers, in his opinion, that the payment, the punishment for these sins which he has voluntarily committed, should be that he's not allowed to do tshuva, that he is prevented from doing tshuva. The ein menichin loy rishus loshuv mirishoy. And the Torah and Hashem doesn't leave him the opportunity to do tshuva, kedei sheyomus veyeyoved bechetoy sheyase, so that he should die and be destroyed for the sin which he committed. And the Rambam goes on to say that is what is meant by Hashem hardening the heart of Paro. That means, what does tshuva mean? The Rambam defines that earlier in Hilchos Tshuva. What does it mean? In order to understand what is meant by Hashem depriving a person of tshuva, we need to understand what is tshuva. So in the beginning of Perek Beis, the Rambam defines tshuva. Mahi ha-tshuva? What is tshuva? Hu sheyazov ha-chotei chetoi? That is, that a sinner should desist from his sin, ve-yosiru mimachshavtoi, and cease to think about it, the yigma belibo shelo yaseyu oid, and decide never to do it again. So he's going to stop doing it, stop thinking about it, and decide never to do it again. V'chein yisnachem al she'ovar, and he should feel uncomfortable and regretful, remorseful about the past. V'tzorich liizvadis bisfosu v'loimer in yonis elu shegoma belibo. And he has to say out aloud these things which he has been thinking in his mind. That is true. So what does it mean when it says Hashem, and the Rambam says Hashem sometimes regards the punishment as being that tshuva should not be possible? That means these things, shiyazov ha-chete es-chete. The sinner is unable to leave his sin. He's unable to feel remorseful about it. He's unable to stop thinking about it. He becomes obsessed with it. He becomes addicted to sin, or to a particular sin. It can happen. That in itself is a punishment. Maybe that's what happens in a lot of cases. A person comes along, a homosexual comes along and says, I can't do tshuva. I don't know what it is. So I'm not responsible. That's what Paro wanted to claim. I have been deprived of the opportunity of doing tshuva. Ask the Rambam, how then can he be punished? Explains the Ramban in Parshas Vayera at the beginning of Perek Zayin. Ki paroi berishoi, paroi in his wickedness, asher also li Yisrael roz gedolis chinom, who did against the Jews many things, many wickednesses which he did not have to do, nitzchayev limnoa mimenu darkei atshuva. His punishment was the removal of tshuva from him, of the possibility of tshuva from him. Kasher bol b'zeh psukim rabim b'toyru v'ksuvim, as is indicated in many psukim in the Torah. Ulefi ma'asov harishonim nidoin. So what is he punished for? Not for not doing tshuva. That's beyond him. He can't do tshuva anymore. That's not what he's punished for. He's punished now for becoming addicted. That was his fault. It's all very well a homosexual can come, or anybody, for example, who has a taiva, who has a yetzahara, which he now can no longer control. And he's obsessed. He's addicted. Let's say it will be decided by the poskim that to smoke is also drug-taking. Let's say drug-taking, which is clearly also. Person says, I can't stop. I just cannot stop. I'm addicted. So what has happened? Monu mimenu darkei atshuva. Hashem has taken away from him the possibility of tshuva. Because what is tshuva, the Rambam defined? Number one, desisting from the act. Number two, removing the act from one's mind. Number three, feeling remorseful about it. And the addict cannot do that. It's not possible. So he claims, I must be excused. The answer is, no, you cannot be excused. You're excused now. When I watch you taking these drugs, all I can feel is sympathy. But you are responsible for getting yourself into the state. Had you not taken the first few, you wouldn't have been in the state now. And the way you are now is part of your punishment for what you did then. And the whole concept of addiction is there to teach us that just as the body can become addicted, so can the soul become addicted. And just as the addict must take responsibility for having become addicted, maybe not for taking his drugs now, he can't help himself, but he's responsible for having become addicted. So the Baal Aveiro, the person who cannot desist from a particular Aveiro, is responsible for getting himself into that state. He shouldn't have got himself into that state. And that's what Paro is punished for. Paro is not punished for not doing tshuva at the end. He couldn't do tshuva at the end. He was addicted to it. Paro was punished for becoming addicted. That was his punishment. And this addiction is something which applies to everybody, not just to extreme cases. Gemara says in Yuma and Daf Pei Vov that over Odom Aveiro Veshonobo, if a person does an Aveiro and does it again, Hutrulo, it becomes permitted for him. Ask the Gemara, Hutrukasakadai, do you really mean that it's permitted? How can it be permitted? No, answers the Gemara, Maseloi Keheter. It becomes as if it's permissible to him. He starts wrong in it. Becomes, you start doing it and the world doesn't collapse. Certain things a person would never do. All of a sudden he does it once and it's quite nice and he gets away with it. He does it a second time and it's even nicer. And he's not struck by lightning. And he does it a third time and a fourth time. After a while that becomes the norm. And it's nicer like heter, it becomes like heter. He becomes addicted. That is addiction. You take a drug, you would never do it. Nobody would ever do it. Chas v'shalom, drugs. What would my parents say? What would my family say? I would never think of it. And it comes one day with a group of friends and they're drinking a little bit and there's lightheadedness and somebody offers him some and it's wonderful. And after a couple of minutes he comes back down to earth and he's back to his normal good self. So he suffered no ill effects and it was quite good. So next time when the same friends invite him out, he goes with a degree of excited anticipation. Maybe he'll have drugs again. And he tries once more, and it's also quite nice. No major problems. And a third time, and a fourth time, and a fifth time. And then he's addicted. And so it is with an Aveira. Where one does something knowing it's wrong, and one feels pleasant sensations, and no severe consequences, one becomes addicted. Nasa lo keheta. So we're not only talking about homosexuals, we're talking about all of us. We do things, we do them once, we do them twice, we do them three times, and they cease to be very serious after a while. they fade into the background and one takes them for granted as one's normal day-to-day life. One has become addicted. And then one wants to do tshuva, comes from kippur, you want to do tshuva, you can't. You just can't stop yourself anymore. And one says, well, okay, if I can't stop myself, I'm anonymous. Talk for a lie, yitzri, what can I do? I've tried and I can't. The answer is, don't think it's so easy. This is part of your punishment. This is part of your punishment. And while we can feel sympathy, and must feel sympathy for any addict, whether he's an addict to a bad mode of moral behavior, or he's an addict to a drug, or to a cigarette, or to alcohol, one has to feel sympathy. Sympathy does not mean that one does not attach responsibility to the person as well. One is able to feel sorry for somebody and to regard him as responsible at the same time. There's nothing wrong with that. A child can do something careless and fall and hurt himself, and the child's crying, you can feel sorry for the child, and you can still say to the child, it's your own fault. Don't do that again. You shouldn't have done it. I told you not to do it. The two emotions are not in conflict with one another. But just as addiction works negatively, so addiction works positively. And the Rambam in the same Perek says, amazing what psychology there is here. Just one Perek, just two halachas of Rambam that we're learning here. One of the reasons that we are held responsible for our actions is shenoson bohem k'ach lilmoidu lahavi. Hashem gave us the power to learn and understand. Shemido zu becholodo. This quality exists in every human being. Rambam makes an unqualified statement. Addict or no addict. Rosho tzadik. Kofo alav yitzroi or not. Everybody has the ability to learn. What is that ability? Shekolz man shehum nimshach bedarche hachochmo vatzedek. That the more a person follows the ways of wisdom and rightness, righteousness and rightness, Misavelohem, he becomes addicted, he craves more wisdom and more righteousness. Vereidefesom, and he pursues them. The Rambam indicates a method of handling addiction with counter-addiction. That's all. You can't stop the drugs, but you can become addicted to righteousness. You can become addicted to wisdom, and you'll soon find the other addictions fall by the way. And perhaps that's part of the mistake that we're making in the treatment of addicts. We think that the first step is get them off the drugs, and then you can start working with them. I'm sure when they're far, far gone, that's how it is. You can't get them onto anything else. It's a very one-track mind. But in the earlier stages, maybe not. Maybe we can addict them to better things than drugs, to the point where they won't need the drugs. And we have a similar concept, if I can find it. Gives us an indication of the wrong line that we're taking. A few halachos here. Let's do them all. Says the Rambam at the end of Hilchus Yisuri Bio, Ein lecho dova b'chol atoiro kulo shehu koshe l'roivom lifrush. There is nothing so hard to desist from for the masses of people, not for individuals, but for the general population. Elo min ha'arayus v'abiyus asuris. Improper intersexual relationships. The hardest thing. Interrelationships between the sexes in a halachically proper way, very difficult. Omru chachomim b'shor shenitzdavu Yisrael ala arayus bochu v'kiblu mitzvazu b'tarumus v'chiyah. Chazal tell us whether when Am Yisrael was given those mitzvahs, they cried. There is such a yetzahora, such an addictive, obsessive relationship to these things that the sexual drive is so powerful that it's the hardest thing to control. V'omru chachomim gezel v'arayus nafshu shelodo misaveloyim echamdesim. And the chachomim has said that theft and improper intersexual relationships people crave for. Theft again doesn't mean necessarily that you rob a bank. theft means that you're not honest in your business dealings. That's theft. And improper sexual intersexual relationships doesn't mean that you rape somebody else's wife. It means that the relationships just aren't proper. The way we speak to one another, the way we handle one another, is not proper. The einato mitzei kol b'chol zman uzman, and you don't find an entire community, an entire society in any generation, she'ein bo em prutzim b'aroyus uviyus asuris, but you don't find people who in this area are unable to control themselves. V'yidamru chachomim roiv b'gezel, and chachomim have also said the majority of people are guilty of theft. Miut b'aroyus, the minority of people are guilty of improper sexual conduct. Everybody in society is guilty of some form of Loshon Hara. Those are three things, three areas which Chazal said people just think the craving, the drive is so strong that one doesn't get away from it. The fichach roi loy la'odam lokuf yitzra. So how do you handle this addiction? If one has to work on oneself, but over there, ulahar gilatz moibi kedusha yisero, to act with kedusha. Uvamachshova tohiro, and with pure thoughts, with the day on the choyno, and with correct attitudes, kedeli not to men to avoid this. So you look at the method. You see the Rambam's approach, Chazal's approach to a certain type of moral addiction, addictiveness. The approach is not you must stop it. You must stop yourself. The approach is to elevate yourself. Elevate yourself spiritually. Below Yeshiv, below Ishon, one should get married. Shimonag Zegerim, the title you say, that helps purity. Gedolo mikol zoysomru. And more than all of this, Chazal have given us a way to handle this incredible drive. How does one handle it? Yifne atzmoy machshavtoy lidivrei tzoyro, v'yarchiv datoy b'chochmo. A person should dedicate himself and his intellect to Torah, and should broaden his mind with wisdom. She'ein machsheves arayus misgaberes elo belev ponui min achochmeh. For one only finds thoughts of improper sexual conduct in minds that are empty and bored. And therefore, if one will find oneself intellectually stimulative and creative, if one will find one's mind operating in Torah and being creative in Torah, this doesn't come into it. Again, one sees the approach. Not to fight it head on. If you're going to fight the addiction head on, you're going to lose. But merely to displace it with things that can bring so much more fulfillment that the addiction becomes a minor issue. It just becomes totally unimportant. So as powerful as these addictions are, there are ways of handling them. What about tshuva? The Rambam did say, we learned, that there are times, such as the case of Paro himself, when tshuva is withheld as a punishment. That is the punishment. No tshuva is possible. Does that mean that if chas v'sholom we have become addicted, that there's no hope? Is that what it means? Good. The Rambam has given us clues and hints as to how not to become addicted. But what happens if one has become addicted? Does that mean there's no hope, that one can't do tshuva, that one cannot desist? The Yerushalmi says in the beginning of Peyo, "Ein lecho dover harimid b'fnei tshuva." There's nothing that can stop tshuva, implying clearly that tshuva is possible in all cases. Could tshuva have taken place in the case of Paro too? Well, we have conflicting views. On the one hand, the Rambam has just told us, "No, that was his punishment. No tshuva." On the other hand, the Yerushalmi says, "Ein lecho dover harimid b'fnei tshuva." Nothing can stand in the front of, in the place of tshuva. It is always possible. Rav Sholom Shvadron, in his notes on Rav Elias Sefer, reconciles this very, very cleverly. He says one of the examples the Rambam gives of tshuva being denied is the case of Bnei Yisrael in the days of Eliyahu. V'chein Yisrael b'mei Eliyahu, l'fi shehirbu lifshea, since they became very sinful, mono me'isem hamarbim lifshea tshuva. Hashem stopped them from the ability to do tshuva, from those people who did so many sins.
שנאמר ועקר הסיבסו אסליבו מאחרניס. For Eliyahu says to Hashem, you have caused this nation to go backwards, to deviate from you. Kleima manosa me'a tshuva, you're stopping them doing tshuva. What was Hashem's response to that attack of Eliyahu? Eliyahu attacks the Ribbono Shel Olam in the most amazing way. This is the case where he's standing on Mount Carmel. The prophets of the Baal have tried to bring their sacrifice. The test was going to be, can you sacrifice without fire? And he brings them all around the altar, and the Baal have to go first. And they try, and they put their meat on the altar, and they sing, and they dance, and they jump, and they shout, and they scream, and they call. Nothing happens. Now there's silence. It's Mincha time, and from here we learn the importance of Mincha, by the way. And Eliyahu stands before his altar, and the whole of Am Yisrael is watching. This is the big test. Baal has failed already, but the experiment has to be controlled. If Eliyahu also fails, then the test is invalid. So Eliyahu has to succeed. He's going to put meat on an altar, which ordinarily he would not be permitted to do because there was a Beis HaMikdash in those days, and sacrifices were permitted to be brought only in the Beis HaMikdash. So for the sake of the spectacle, he is deviating from the pure halacha, and the future of Klal Yisrael depends on his success. And he turns to Hashem and he says, Vayihi Balos HaMincha, it was at Mincha time, Vayigash Eliyahu HaNovi, and in the silence that was held while everybody was holding their breath to see what would be, Eliyahu draws up Vayomer and he says, Hashem Elokei Avram Yitzchok v'Yisrael, Hashem God of Avram Yitzchok v'Yisrael, Hayoim Yivoda Ki Ato Elokim v'Yisrael V'ani Avdecha, let it be known today that you are the God of Israel and I am your servant. Uvidvorcho Sisi is called Advoim Eile, and whatever I did by your word. Aneini Hashem, Aneini, answer me Hashem. Now he doesn't stop there and say, answer me. He goes on and says, Veyedu ha'om azek yu ato Hashem Elikim, and let this people acknowledge that you are God. Ve'ato ha'sei voiso es libo machoironis, because you, as the Rambam interprets this passage, you have denied them the opportunity of tshuva. And I am now appealing to you to let them know that you're God and acknowledging that you're God. What is Eliyahu asking? To reverse the decree. You've denied them the opportunity of tshuva. Why doesn't Eliyahu throw up his hands and say, well, Vayechazek is libo, that's the case of Paro. And we saw Paro couldn't do tshuva, so it's too late. Let me emigrate, and these people, we'll have to lose them. What can I do? He turns to Hashem and he says, Hashem, let them acknowledge that you are God. Everybody waits. Vatipol eish Hashem vatecha v'sa'ilo v'sa'itzim v'sa'avonim v'sa'ofar, and a fire came down from heaven and consumed the meat and the wood and the altar, the lot. V'sa'mayim asher b'ta'alu l'checho, and it consumed the water in the canal. V'ayal kol ha'om, and all the people saw. V'ayiplu al p'neim, and they fell upon their faces. V'ayimru, and they said, Hashem hu ha'elukim, Hashem hu ha'elukim, they did tshuva. And that's an example the Rambam brings of a case where tshuva was denied from them. Says of Sholem Shadron, tshuva is denied as a gezeira, that's their punishment. That there's such a thing as tefillah, as prayer being able to tear, to be korea gezeira. One can reverse a decree. And so the proper procedure then is for the addict to say, yes, I'm responsible, maybe not for the drug I'm about to take, for I can't control myself, I'm addicted. But I acknowledge that I'm responsible for the first drug that I took, for that made me addicted. But what can I do? I can no longer do tshuva. So I might as well enjoy what I'm doing? No. He should then, before he takes his drug, turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam with tears in his eyes and say, Ribbono Shel Olam, you have punished me with a most terrible decree. You have caused me to become addicted, which means you have removed from me the opportunity of tshuva. You have denied me the opportunity to acknowledge my wrong and reverse my actions. I can't do it. My body won't let me do it. Hashem, tear that gezeira, destroy that decree, and then I will do tshuva. And that we see in the case of Eliyahu can work. And that's what the Yerushalmi means. Ein lecho dover harim ha'bitzei ha'tshuva. Even Pyro could have done tshuva. Had he turned to Hashem and said, Hashem, I don't know what's happened to me. I've become addicted to destroying the Jews. I can't stop. And the only way I can explain that, Hashem, is that you have now deprived me of the opportunity to do tshuva, and you've done it as a punishment because I made myself addicted to it. Hashem, reverse that decree and let me do tshuva. Then he would be able to do tshuva. But until he does that, that wouldn't be possible. And so we see that we're not prepared to make peace that easily with human nature and with addictiveness. Not only are we not prepared to make peace in the sense of responsibility, that we were responsible for becoming addicted, but we're even expected to reverse the addiction. It can be done. It's hard, but it can be done. Not naturally. By nature, the decree is no tshuva. The decree is that by all natural means, you cannot reverse it anymore. But the Jew is always able to rise above nature. And that's the most important limud of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's the most important limud of coming out of Egypt. We had in the Lady Shir today a case where the king of Ashur attacked the land of Israel and exiled the 10 tribes to Babylon, to Ashur. And in his place he sent goyim to populate the land so the land shouldn't be desolate. And these goyim were idolaters. But so were the Jews who were exiled. That's why Hashem allowed them to be exiled. These goyim were idolaters, and lions came and started eating them up. And they sent a message to the king saying the reason that the lions are coming to eat us up is because we don't know the ethics of this and the religious practices of this country. And that's why it's consuming us. And the king said, fine, I'll send one of the Kohanim, I'll send one of the priests who used to be in Israel, back to teach you how to do it. And the Tanakh tells us that he came and he taught them how to fear God, but they carried on with their idolatry, with their idols. Each little nation had their own idols and their own idolatrous practice. They carried on and they served God as well. They would go to shul on Shabbos and to church on Sunday. And the lions stopped, no more consuming of the lions. And we asked the ladies here today, but that's exactly what the Jews were doing. The Jews were also serving idolatry and believing in Hashem. And they were exiled for it. And these goyim came along and they're doing it, and that's fine. And we learned from the Tanakh that the claim against the Jews was that a Jew is not allowed to do that, whereas a non-Jew is. A non-Jew is allowed to worship God and other forces together, because a non-Jew is governed by God and other forces together. God has created systems and cycles and forces. He's created astrological constellations, and he's created economic cycles, and he's created agricultural and geographical cycles, and all these things affect the non-Jew, but they needn't affect the Jew. That we learned at Yetzias Mitzrayim. By all the laws of sociology and economics, a slave couldn't escape from Egypt, but the Jews did. By all the laws of nature, the nation that escaped from Egypt when they hit the Red Sea should have been exterminated by the attacking army, but the Jews weren't. They got across the Red Sea. By all laws of nature, if the Red Sea did split when the Jews got across the other side, so would have some Egyptians, and they would have exterminated them on the other side. But they didn't. The Egyptians died and the Jews got across. By all the laws of nature, once you were across, you should have died of hunger, but the Jews didn't. They survived and lived very well. By all the laws of nature, if they had what to eat, they would have died of thirst. But the Jews didn't. They had what to drink as well. We learn from Yetzias Mitzrayim that the Jew is able to overpower nature. But not only nature in the object, not only external nature, that we know that you can overpower. The important limud of Yetzias Mitzrayim is that you can overpower your own nature too. And that even when your body is addicted, or when your soul is addicted, there is still a way out for a Jew. He can overpower that addictiveness. He can get rid of that habit. It's hard. But Yisrael Salanter said it's harder to kick a habit than it is to learn through the whole of Shas. And learning through the whole of Shas the way that Yisrael Salanter learned is not easy. It's extremely difficult, but it can be done. That's the power that the human being has got. And that's the power we needed before starting to count Sfiras HaEmet. You can't prepare yourself for Kabbalah HaTorah if you don't know that you have within you the resources to overcome your own nature and to overpower yourself, never mind overpower everything else. That's the reason. and say, yes, there is a principle of Tokfa Alav Yitzroi. Yes, a person can sometimes claim, I'm addicted, I'm obsessed, there's nothing I can do. And we feel sympathy for such a person. And maybe that's good enough reason to allow him to give evidence, because we might say, well, he's addicted and that's why he does it. It's not because he's essentially a bad person, and therefore he's not necessarily going to be dishonest in court just because he's misbehaving sexually. That could be because he's just a weak character and he can't control himself, but that doesn't mean we condone it. That doesn't mean we relieve him of responsibility. He is responsible, number one. If he acts with relish, then he's responsible for everything. But if he acts with guilt, then true, maybe he's not responsible for what he's doing now. He's addicted. But he's responsible for having done it in the first place, for having become addicted, and he remains responsible for that. He can still have our sympathy, but at the same time he has to know that he's responsible. But at all times there must also be the knowledge that he can overcome that addiction. That it is possible for him to appeal to Hashem to reverse the gezeirah and to allow him the opportunity of doing tshuva. And if his tefillah is very resourceful and with great energy and sincerity, Hashem will listen to it. And Hashem will allow him the opportunity to do tshuva and to overcome the powers of nature that have caused him to become obsessed and addicted. When one sees at the power we have, that even to overcome an addiction we can, that even to overcome an obsession we can, how much easier is it to overcome the little impulses we have now and again, to do little wrong things, not addictions, no great obsessions, a little yetzahara. That's easy for us compared to all this. Put our feet down and say, no, this time we're going to decide, we're going to determine where we go and what we do. We're not going to be led by our little impulses. We're not going to be led by our little cravings and our little desires. We're big enough to overcome our natures even when we're addicted and obsessed. How much more so to direct our natures when we're not yet addicted and obsessed? And how careful we have to be not to become addicted and obsessed. To understand that Kivan Shehovar Adam Aveira Veshonabo, at the moment a person does an Aveira and repeats it and repeats it, Naseh Lekeheto, he becomes addicted. We've got to watch it and watch it to see that we only become addicted to good things. For that power, the Rambam said, was given to every human being, to learn and to understand that drive which, after seeking wisdom and kedusha and righteousness, causes one to become just as addicted to the goodness and to the righteousness, which fills our minds and fills our hearts, and thus displaces from us all the negative drives and impulses.